Greetings. It's 1 o'clock, everyone, and time for Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. George Carlin once said that they call it the American dream because you've got to be sleeping to believe it's true. We've got a guest today who's going to tell you, no, we can rebuild the American dream and make it here when you're wide awake. Our guest will be Van Jones today, but before we go to him, let's go to Media Matters.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. Where commercial media are consolidating and slashing newsroom jobs, vibrant local journalism nonprofits are popping up across the country to fill the gaps. But they've hit one big bureaucratic snag with the IRS. The Chronicle of Philanthropy reported this month that many nonprofit journalism organizations have been waiting for more than a year to hear whether the IRS has approved their 501c3 tax status. While they wait, organizations cannot accept foundation grants or tax-deductible donations. Tax lawyers interviewed by the Chronicle suggest that the IRS is bundling all the nonprofit news organization applications together and studying them carefully because they have the potential to set precedent. The question is, how long can these small publishers wait? Brant Houston is board chairman of the Investigative News Network, which represents 60 nonprofit news organizations. INN submitted its application to the IRS nearly 16 months ago.
What's happening is that you have various organizations that are waiting to get grants, have possible funding out there, and because of this limbo, they may lose that opportunity and then possibly go under.
As traditional news models have crumbled, the question on everyone's mind has been how to fund quality journalism. Many have pointed to nonprofit news outlets as the answer.
With the major loss of advertising revenue, you have everyone still in the for-profit and nonprofit world trying to figure out how to pay good journalists to do investigative and public service reporting. And it's the kind of reporting that exposes wrongdoing, prevents fraud and waste, causes change for the better, protects the weak, all this kind of reporting that is so crucial.
Houston fears the delay at the IRS could impact this burgeoning commitment to non-commercial journalism.
Our big problem here is a movement from profit to nonprofit in providing public service stories is on the verge of being strangled by this limbo.
The nonprofit San Francisco Public Press has been waiting for 21 months for IRS approval, the Lens in New Orleans for 1 year. The INN is conducting a study to see who among its members is still waiting for word and for how long.
And the more I see what people are going through, all people of all races, of all colors, of all creeds, the more I see that, the more angry it makes me. We say all the time that it's the telling of truth. It's the telling of truth that allows suffering to speak.
Last summer, PBS journalist and television host Tavis Smiley and Princeton professor Dr. Cornel West toured 18 cities in 11 states to discuss poverty in America. To help organize and document the tour, Smiley turned to the Media Mobilizing Project, a Philadelphia-based organization committed to ending poverty and creating a media and communications infrastructure for the people, by the people. The project holds a variety of workshops, provides access to computers and media-making technology, and runs a TV show, several radio shows, and a local news website. MMP's Brian Mercer.
We've brought up a number of folks from the ranks of poor and working people to be able to produce this media and be able to share these stories. And so not only the perspective and insight into these different communities and into these different issues, but also the experience of these communities being able to document and tell their own stories was a reason for us to be a part of the tour.
Three MMP staff members accompanied Smiley and West for the six-day tour, meeting with workers, farmers, homeless veterans, and families on the verge of foreclosure from Chicago to Mississippi to Detroit. Mercer says the timing of the Poverty Tour program, which aired earlier this month, couldn't have been better with the rise of the Occupy Wall Street movement. He praised public media for airing truthful depictions of poor and working people.
It's a moment where our country needs to be having these discussions in our homes and out on the streets of what the economic recession has done, what the experience of poverty is like, and how we come together across our many differences to do something about these things. And so seeing PBS as a resource and a platform to be able to talk about those things and spark that discussion is an exciting part of being a part of this.
You can watch Smiley's five-part series, The Poverty Tour, A Call to Conscience, on pbs.org. And you can check out the Media Mobilizing Project at mediamobilizing.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. Our guest today, someone we've been wanting to have for a very long time, is Van Jones, the head of the organizer of the new group Rebuild the Dream, the American Dream Movement, well known to many Americans for his work in the green economy, the green collar economy, author of the book The Green Collar Economy, which was a bestseller, published in 2008, and the founder and first starter of the Color for Change organization in 2005. Van Jones, as a full disclosure, was on the board of Free Press along with me for many years, and it is a privilege and an honor to welcome today to Media Matters. Van, welcome aboard.
I'm glad to be aboard.
Well, let's get right down to what you're working on now, because you've been very busy throughout the summer of 2011 and going into the fall. With your Rebuild the Dream, the American Dream Movement, what was the inspiration for this? What was the idea for this? And what are you trying to accomplish?
Well, I think the main inspiration and idea was I spent about a year teaching at Princeton, and I was, you know, looking around the American landscape. And I thought to myself, if I'm one of these students, if I wanted to join a movement that was going to do something about the economy, and I was on the right, it would be very obvious what movement I should join. That movement is called the Tea Party movement, whatever you think of it. It is visible, it's loud, it's clear. I said, what if I were wanting to join a movement that was on the left, or even a moderate movement that wanted to do something about jobs and the economy? The polls say that jobs are the number one issue, the economy is the main concern. If I'm a conservative, I can join the Tea Party. What do I join if I'm not? And I realized that I couldn't come up with an answer. And I thought this was quite remarkable. Progressives are actually pretty good at creating organizations, sometimes to a fault. But certainly, if you're concerned about women's issues, you can think of, off the top of your head, NOW, Planned Parenthood, et cetera, African-American issues, the NAACP, the environment, Sierra Club, NRDC, et cetera. And yet, here we are 3 years into the biggest economic catastrophe since the Great Depression, and I can't name a single national name brand organization outside the labor movement that is focused on the economy. And so I said, this seems to be a big oversight. So I talked to a large number of other progressive leaders who also thought that this was a big hole in the donut. And we decided what we would do is to support the emergence and the consolidation of what we had to come up with a name for it. We said, call it the American Dream Movement. There are so many people out there fighting against these horrible cutbacks, against these terrible policies, fighting for jobs, fighting for an economic future. But we're all fighting individually, a foreclosure fight over here, trying to get jobs for veterans over there, standing up against unjustified cutbacks here and union busting there. All these fights are happening, a massive fight back, but it doesn't have a common banner to show the world that there are people who have better ideas for America's economy than just saying, let's destroy Medicare. And so we launched something in the summer called the American Dream Movement. We set up a website called rebuildthedream.com. And the idea is that we have this online support center to support all of these different causes standing together finally as one movement.
And I went to the website, I've been to it several times, and it's really an extraordinary group of co-sponsors that the organization has. I've not really ever seen anything quite like it, certainly among progressives, and I doubt there's ever anything like it anywhere else. Talk about some of the groups that you're aligned with in the American Dream Movement.
Well, we're really proud. I think we have now close to 80 organizations. Some of them are name brand organizations that you would know anywhere in the United States. For instance, MoveOn.org is powering this effort. They have contributed the technology to make it possible to make this movement work. But everything from Faithful America to Planned Parenthood, from the AFL-CIO and SEIU, some of our biggest labor organizations, to the new labor movement, which includes the Domestic Workers Alliance, et cetera. 70 grassroots organizations. I'm especially proud that the Campaign for America's Future, led by Bob Borisage, came in very early and actually moved its national annual conference from the summer, the famous Take Back America conference that was held every summer, to the fall. And they changed the name of the conference to Take Back the American Dream, to show its support and solidarity with the American Dream movement and the idea that the killers of the American Dream in D.C. on Wall Street and on Wall Street should be defeated by this movement to save and rebuild and reinvent the American Dream. I'm also super proud that the Center for Community Change, led by Deepak Bhargava, has stepped up and has played a tremendous role in getting low-income people and people of color engaged early and aggressively. And I could go on and on bragging on these different organizations. Democracy for America has adopted the Don't Kill the American Dream slogan for itself and is running an incredibly impressive campaign. And even the word American Dream is appearing in the big march that Al Sharpton is doing. He's not formally a part of this, but the march he's doing right before the dedication of the Martin Luther King memorial also is about jobs, justice, and the American dream. So this meme, this metaphor, this theme is beginning to become, I think, a unifying, rallying point, the idea that the American dream itself is being killed off, not the American dream of commercialism and consumerism, and if you just buy a bunch of stuff, you'll be happy. You know, that's the American fantasy, and that has led to a nightmare for most Americans. We just mean the basic idea that you shouldn't have to be rich, you shouldn't have to have a famous last name to be able to work hard in America, play by the rules, and give your kids a better life. But that should not be reserved to a tiny minority of the rich and the lucky, but that everyone in America should have that opportunity. And we should not live in a country where the majority of people work harder and harder and cannot find a way to succeed, and a tiny minority breaks every rule that it can and yet is never allowed to fail because they're considered to be too big to fail. That is not what the American dream is supposed to be about. We can reinvent the American dream to be better for the people and for the planet, but the basic idea that of a meritocracy and there being a ladder in this country that willing people can find a way to climb, that is not something we should be willing to throw under the bus just because somebody doesn't want rich people and corporations to pay their taxes.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Van Jones, the founder. And do you have a title with the group, Van?
I am now the president, which means I get to talk a lot, but we're actually very proud that the CEO of RebuildTheDream.com is a young woman named Natalie Foster. And Natalie Foster is amazing. She was with the Organizing for America effort, the online social media effort associated with President Obama. She also was at MoveOn.org and with the Sierra Club, still in her early 30s, just a true superstar in the online organizing world. She has come on to be the CEO. I am the president, so I get a chance to brag on her a lot.
All right, so you're the president of Rebuild the Dream, and this is a recorded program here on WILL AM 580. So, dear listeners, please don't call in today. Sit back and let Van Jones and me, Bob McChesney, do the yakking today. There's a lot to talk about. Van Jones, what's the idea behind the group? I mean, what, or better, maybe to be more tangible about that, what is going to be the relationship of Rebuild the Dream to in the American Dream movement, to the Democratic Party on one hand, and to electoral politics on the other hand?
Well, you know, we are not a partisan organization. We are incorporated, you know, 501c3 and C4, and our job is to do for sane, progressive economic ideas what the Tea Party did for ideas that fit neither category. And in other words, make both parties pay attention to a set of ideas. But the difference between what the American Dream movement represents and what the Tea Party movement represents is that the American Dream movement is standing for mainstream majority ideas. You know, 60 to 70%, and depending on the poll, as many as 90% of Americans agree with Warren Buffett that wealthier people who received all the tax breaks and all and benefited from the bailouts should start paying America back now by paying full taxes. That is an absolutely majority point of view, and yet it is a minority view in the halls of Congress. That is because a minority faction, the Tea Party, has been able to hijack the process, hijack the conversation, and prevent the will of the people from being carried through. The majority of Americans, vast majority, 60% or more, believe it is time for us to wind down these wars overseas and bring the troops home and bring the money home, $3 billion a week, I believe it is, every week, that's being spent overseas. But what could you do with $3 billion, $3 billion in your community, just 1 week's worth of expenditures, that those loyal, hardworking troops and those dollars should come back home to fix America? That's not a minority fringe opinion. That's 60 to 70% of Americans agree with that. The vast majority of Americans agree that job creation now and the federal government being focused on job creation now is much more important and much smarter than focusing on long-term deficit reduction, or certainly not that phony default crisis that the Tea Party cooked up.
Yeah, can I stop you there? Because you make some wonderful points. You're covering a lot of ground here. But as you talked about all those issues, what was striking to me was that while the Tea Party is clearly pushing the minority position, I think the evidence is unequivocal on that, they're also attacking Barack Obama, President Obama, as being their sort of arch enemy and the person on the other side of the trenches. But when one looks at President Obama and his administration on the very issues you've just described, he hardly seems to be carrying the mantle of the American Dream movement.
Well, I think that one thing I have learned is, you know, I spent 6 months working in the administration, and I was 6 months, the proudest 6 months of my life, followed by probably the toughest 2 weeks when I resigned. But as you know, I got a chance to see close up the way Washington, D.C. works. And I came away convinced that Washington, D.C. will never be any better than the American people. It will never be any more courageous, any more idealistic, any more determined than the American people. And when those of us who were a part of that great movement for hope and for change in America got across what we thought was a finish line in November 2008, and we failed to recognize that was a starting line. That was when we really should have then began to mobilize. And by failing to do that, we, I think, have made it impossible for D.C. to function properly. I think the work of democracy is not the work of one person in the White House or any other house. It's the work of millions of people. And we have not had a vehicle or a mechanism to bring some balance back to the discussion in Washington, D.C., and either allow the White House to take better positions or force the White House to take better positions. Until you have that mechanism in place, you don't know what the White House would or would not be willing to do. Unfortunately, we are in a situation where because of the corporate-funded media, especially focused on with Fox Television, and this Tea Party movement being able to capitalize upon some disaffection in the midterms, the system has been taken off the rails. And we've got to get the whole system and both parties focused back on intelligent answers and real solutions. And there's nobody more frustrated than I am by the outcome and the heartbreak everybody's feeling with D.C. just being so dysfunctional. But I think, and I'm happy to hear and to add to any critiques of the Democratic Party. But our job isn't to fix the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. Our job is to give the American people a voice, and we expect both parties to pay attention.
You know, Van Jones, I've heard lots of really smart activists make the same argument you've made or a similar one, and I think it makes a lot of sense that activists can't just wait for leaders to do their job. They've got to sort of organize and force them to do the right thing and show the troops in the street, so to speak. And FDR's famous line to the labor movement was, make me do the Wagner Act. Force me and I'll do it, but I can't do it on my own. But at the same time, to me at least, I think it must have been a bit disheartening that one of the few times we've seen the Obama administration show emotion towards its enemies was when the first press secretary, Carney's predecessor, I can't remember the guy's name offhand, and Rahm Emanuel, when he's chief of staff, both sort of got viscerally angry at MoveOn and Daily Coast and when they weren't showing sufficient levels of support for the president, when they were pushing him precisely on the issues on your agenda for the American Dream movement. It was a rare bit of anger. It was only shown in one direction, it seemed like.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is important, we can focus a lot as progressives on what is not happening in the White House or what is happening in the White House that we don't like. And there seems to have emerged now a whole cottage industry online and now on the air of people who are doing that. I have no problem with that. My only problem is it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't actually change anything. You know, when I worked in the White House, I couldn't get the president to do what I wanted him to do every day, and I worked there. When I left the White House, I was surprised to find so many of my colleagues with, you know, writing against these listservs or whatever, these long speeches the president should give. I worked in the White House. I couldn't write the speeches for the guy. Most of us out here don't work in the White House. We do not have an ability directly to affect what the White House does, and yet we spend literally hours upon hours ruminating about why don't they do this, why don't they do this. This is a prescription for helplessness. It's a prescription for powerlessness. And it has no precedent in the progressive movement. The progressive movement, when it is effective, doesn't, you know, the civil rights movement leadership didn't sit down and say, when will Johnson give the speech we want to hear? When is Johnson going to lead us? The labor movement didn't sit down and wait for FDR to lead them. The abolitionists didn't sit down and wait for Lincoln to lead them. They created an independent force that then the progressive head of state had to respond to. Now, my frustration is that we seem to have confused the role of head of state and movement leader. There is no precedent in American history, in progressive history, for the head of state leading the progressive movement. The movement leadership function is a separate function from the head of state function. And as long as we expect that Barack Obama to both be, or President Obama, to both be head of state, to both be LBJ and to be Dr. King, to both be Abraham Lincoln and to be Frederick Douglass, to both be the head of the labor unions and to be FDR, we are just going to be endlessly frustrated. And so whatever critique you have of Obama, if you think he's just, you know, selling us down the river, or if you think he's just handcuffed by the right wing, whatever your critique is, at the end of the day, if we are not building independent movement power as our fathers and our mothers and our grandparents did, to hold whoever is in the White House accountable to the needs of the American people, I don't think we are going to see much difference in the outcome.
Okay, but then at the end of the next day, because I think you're right, when the Tea Party, like you've talked about, does their organizing, they've got a laundry list of issues they're really keen on, like lowering taxes on rich people and getting rid of social spending programs like Social Security and getting rid of public education and unions. It seems like they've got a checklist And they hold their leaders, if not the president, the head of the Republican Party in the House and Senate, Boehner and McConnell and that crowd, accountable to that checklist. And and they still have their movement, but at least they're held accountable. And if they don't deliver, heads roll and they raise hell. I go down your checklist, and you've got 10 extraordinary issues. And I think you're absolutely right. On each of these issues, polling shows majority support. Yet on each of the 10, the majority opinion is not even inside the range of legitimate debate in Washington. I mean, isn't it fair to say, okay, we have a movement like the Tea Party. We're going to say, why aren't you on our side of this? And heads are going to roll if you don't get on our side.
I think that is the logical outcome of the process that we have started. But we have just started the process. And the first thing that we did, just to make sure that your listeners who may have actually had a summer vacation and may not be following all this stuff very closely, the first thing that we did over the summer was we issued a call to ask Americans if they had ways or ideas to fix America's economy that wouldn't involve destroying Medicare and Social Security the way that Paul Ryan wants to do it. Well, we were hoping to get about 500 to 1,000 good ideas that we could then boil down to 10. We didn't get 1,000 good ideas. We got 24,000 ideas from Americans. Some of them were duplicative, but some of them were highly original. And it turned out there's just a tremendous amount of wisdom in the American people. 24,000 people went online within 3 days and gave us ideas. And we reposted those ideas, and we had a tool online at rebuildthedream.com for people to rate and rank those ideas. We got 6.1 million ratings and rankings of those ideas, and we produced this contract for the American Dream. And the contract for the American Dream is our crowdsourced document, our agenda, as you said, to hold people accountable. And we are now taking that around the country, asking elected officials and other leaders to endorse it and to sign on. But until you do that hard work, though, it's very difficult to just go and tell someone, we don't like what you voted on this one thing, or you didn't say this, we didn't like this speech, your head's going to roll. You have to establish the basis. So we have, I think, done a heroic effort there. Those 10 points do poll. It just turns out, we didn't care how they polled, but it turns out that all those 10, every one of those 10 points, including infrastructure, green jobs, education, saving, Medicare, Social Security.
Yeah, we'll go through each of them later. Yeah. We'll go through them in detail.
Sure. We'll get every one of those points. It turns out polls above 50% and some poll in the upper 70s. So what that means is that there is now a basis to then begin to build some actual power. And the next step in that process is this Take Back the American Dream Summit, October 2nd through 5th. In Washington, D.C., where we were going to bring thousands of people together to debate and discuss these issues. Coming out of that summit, we think we will have some prerequisites for real change. We will have a clear agenda. We will expect to have the buy-in of lots of grass tops, but much more importantly, grassroots leaders. And we will also be walking out of that into a pretty big fight over the budget and over this committee of 12 that, seems to be on track to imposing an austerity agenda on the country in a very undemocratic way. And there will be a fight. But the fight is to lift up the ideas of the middle class in America and to defend and protect and promote the interests of working folks and people who want to be working folks. It's not a fight primarily to say we don't like President Obama, or we don't like the Democrats, or we don't like the Tea Party. We believe that these are the ideas that will make America better. We'll work with anybody to get those ideas put in place, and we'll work against anybody to get those ideas put in place. But until we have that agenda and a solid basis to move forward, it's difficult to jump ahead and say who we're going to be opposing or not opposing.
Our guest today in Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Van Jones, the president of the American Dream Movement, which you can find at rebuildthedream.org. Is that right, Ben?
It's actually .com.
.com, yeah. I wanted to make sure I got the .dot correct. But I'm sure if you just enter in a search engine, Rebuild the Dream or American Dream Movement or Van Jones, I know from experience, you will end up at the proper website very quickly. He's joining us. It's a recorded program, so please don't try to call in today to WILL AM 580. Let us do the talking. We're talking about the American Dream Movement, just launched in the summer of 2011, as really one of the most ambitious progressive political undertakings in years, if not a generation, and a very exciting movement. Before we get back to it, Van Jones, you alluded to your 2 weeks of unpleasantness as you left the White House, courtesy of the Glenn Beck television show and Fox News. And I've had a small taste of what you got 59 helpings of in that 2 weeks. And I think more than anyone possibly can, what it must have been like for you and your family. Just a little bit, you know, what that feels like to be attacked as you were on really basically scurrilous charges and your ability to defend yourself.
Well, you know, that was a long time ago, of course. That was 2 years ago. So for a lot of people, that you know, that's what they mainly remember about me, and it's always important for me to make sure people remember. I got a chance to work for 6 months in the White House, which is 6 months longer than I ever expected to work in the White House. It's not like I'm not a politician or somebody who set out to work in government. As you know, and as we've known each other for years, my work up until then had been working with underprivileged kids in Oakland and the Bay Area, trying to get them out of jail and into jobs. And, you know, when you do that kind of work, that's not the usually the normal pathway to get a job advising in the White House, but I had done a good enough job that people like Nancy Pelosi and others had lifted up my work, and we had even gotten George W. Bush in 2007 to sign the Green Jobs Act, which I had proposed along with Hilda Solis. And so on the basis of that work and my best-selling book, which became a cornerstone for energy policy for the transition to the new administration, I was invited to come and work as an advisor for some period of time. Those 6 months will always be the biggest honor I ever had. And as difficult as it was to leave, I tell you right now, anybody, if you could have it in the contract, you get a chance to spend 6 months in the White House and then leave exactly the way that I left, sign the contract. It is still totally worth it. I wouldn't wish the pain on anybody. But the opportunity to serve at that level is a privilege and not a right in our country, and I'll never complain about a single part of it. What I will say is that the Tea Party itself taught me a great deal, watching how they were able to derail probably the most hopeful movement in American politics since at least the 1960s, around Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy. And we had spent 40 years from 68 to 2008 in somewhat of a wilderness, and to have a moment emerge where that all that hope and idealism around Bobby Kennedy and Dr. King and others came back, and to have it taken away in such a short period of time, the Tea Party got some things right. And we have to recognize that their tactics, not just the dishonest, disgusting ones, but even the ones that are just new and improved versions, deserve careful study. And one thing about them, you mentioned Glenn Beck, look at the resilience and the strength of their movement, the Tea Party movement. Sarah Palin has fallen down the stairwell of public opinion. The Tea Party just as strong as ever. Glenn Beck lost his TV show, is now, you know, relegated to some website someplace. But the Tea Party, just as strong as ever. We have to start building movements around principles and values and ideals, not charismatic individuals. Now, that doesn't mean there are not charismatic individuals in the Tea Party. There certainly are. And it doesn't mean there won't be charismatic spokespersons in the American Dream movement. I hope there will be dozens. But never again can we allow our movement to be reduced to a single person's last name. And whatever that single individual does or doesn't do becomes the sum total of our movement. That can never happen again. The part of what we're trying to do with the American Dream movement is to get enough organizations and enough leaders speaking out for the American Dream that if one of us or another one of us goes the wrong way or wants to cut some awful deal, the rest of us can still be standing and moving forward.
How important was the Wisconsin uprising of the winter and spring of 2011 to the vision you have for the American Dream movement?
It is the source. It is the spark. It is the sum total of my view about what can make a difference in our country, which is you had the farmers, you had the students, you had the workers, you had unionized workers whose necks were not on the chopping block, standing up anyway. And it was very clear that there was no one leader that it was all about. In fact, that was its great strength. And I saw in watching the Tea Party a smart swarm, a leaderless swarm emerge, watching Madison move in the same way, watching, frankly, things in Egypt moving the same way, I began to say to myself, I think we call ourselves progressive, but I think that this hierarchical follow one leader direction that we found ourselves in is anachronistic. That is for the last century. The new century, change will be made by smart swarms like the smart swarm that emerged in Madison and brought hope to people there, and like the swarm that came out of the far libertarian right wing and derailed our movement for hope and change.
One of the big issues in Wisconsin, and as well as in a number of other states where there is both a Republican governor and Republican control of both chambers of the state legislature, is strong efforts to make it much more difficult for poor people and students to be able to vote. This comes on top of the evidence that is now emphatic that voting is very much class skewed in the United States. If you break it down by deciles or quintiles, the poorest people vote at a much lower rate. As you go right up the ladder to the upper 10 or 20%, where they vote at much higher rates. How important is this battle for the franchise and getting people to exercise their franchise to the American Dream movement?
That's absolutely critical. In fact, in trying to crowdsource our economic agenda, what kept pushing through was this need to reclaim and strengthen our democracy. What people weren't just saying, oh, well, tax wealthy people or spend money on infrastructure. People were saying, get our democracy back in the hands of ordinary people and out of the hands of these corporations. And a big part of that is the idea that we should have this crazy radical notion of one person, one vote. And it is such it's just disgusting to watch the Republican Party in particular looking down the long barrel of a millennial generation, a younger generation that does not share its worldview, and then rather than adapting itself as a party to maybe listen to this younger generation that is, for instance, much more tolerant on and understanding and inclusive when it comes to issues of race and gender and sexuality, much more interested in solving problems and working together to do so than, frankly, the Generation Xers or the baby boomers. Maybe the Republicans could listen to that generation and learn from it. No, instead, we're seeing a systematic effort in almost every state where Republicans have the state house to make it harder for those young people to participate. So rather than learn from the young people and listen to the young people, they want to silence the young people. And this is not hyperbole. Literally saying that young people cannot vote, register to vote in the places where they go to college. Well, that is ridiculous. What random Tuesday is someone supposed to drive across the state or get in a plane and go vote back in their hometown? As best I can tell, most elections take place during the school year. You would want to encourage college students, you would think, to develop the habit of voting if you're concerned about America. Instead, they're trying to chop off the hands of young people as they reach for the ballot. This is the sort of disgusting behavior, anti-democratic behavior, the Republican Party is resorting to because it knows it cannot win over this young generation of voters because they actually need America's government to be active and actively involved in ensuring that global warming doesn't happen and ensuring that these wars don't go on forever and ensuring that there is a ladder of opportunity in our country for them to climb.
One of the other great developments, Van Jones, great not in a approving sense, but great in a significant sense, that's happened since you left the White House and in the last 2 years with dramatic effect upon American politics has been the Citizens United decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court in January 2010, which now allows effectively for unlimited amounts of anonymous money from corporations to fund political campaigns. How is this going to affect the calculus of what you're doing with the American Dream Movement and really for people in general, progressives, anyone?
Well, I mean, it's a huge threat to our country. It's a huge threat to democracy. One of the reasons that we wanted to get the American Dream Movement going was that we thought that we were going to have a much bigger fight on our hands to ensure that ordinary people's voices are heard in either party. And that's why, again, we launched late June. We already have 500,000 members. We are in every congressional district. We, again, have a contract for the American Dream, a jobs agenda that 131,000 Americans worked on together. We, during the phony default crisis that the Tea Party whipped up, we had rallies and protests in every congressional district, including as many as a total of about 40,000 people. And we think that people power can ultimately defeat the corporate attempt to take over our democracy, but not if all we do is complain about what the folks in D.C. do or don't do. Those days have to come to an end, and we have to begin to organize ourselves. We have to begin to educate ourselves, and we have to begin to put pressure on the system in ways we know will be effective, which has to do with taking the court of taking our case out into the court of public opinion, not just blogging and complaining among ourselves, but actually being willing to get back out in the streets again and stand up in front of farmers markets and go into laundromats and talk to people and begin to build real power. This is what the Tea Party was willing to do. We have to be willing to do that. The Tea Party was very disappointed in the Republican Party's performance and changed that by organizing. And I think we're disappointed in both parties' performance, and we can change that by organizing.
Our guest, Van Jones, here on Media Matters. Again, this is a pre-recorded show, so please don't call in. Van Jones is the president of the American Dream Movement. You can find it at rebuildthedream.com. Started here in 2011, already 500,000 members. Van Jones, if someone's listening to the show, and we're aired primarily in Illinois, here in based out of Urbana, Champaign, but we have a national, even an international audience, thanks to the internet and the World Wide Web and podcasting. If someone anywhere in the United States is listening to this show and says, this sounds like a good thing, you got 500,000 members. I want to get involved. What does it mean to be a member of your group? Is it just you pay dues and then sit back and wait for marching orders?
No, there's no dues. We should probably change that.
I get a commission then for the idea.
Well, first of all, just to be clear, I'm the president of Rebuild the Dream.
Okay.
You can find that at rebuildthedream.com. We are the support center for what we call the American Dream Movement. The American Dream Movement is, 80 groups and 500,000 members and all
okay.
that. And people get it confused even on staff sometimes. So Rebuild the Dream as a president. The American Dream Movement doesn't have a president. Movements don't have presidents. They have
okay.
principles. And so just to be clear about that, I think I was not clear about that earlier. That said, the first thing someone could and should do is to go online and sign up. If you don't have access to a computer, we apologize. As we get bigger, we hope to be able to accommodate folks who can't easily sign up. But right now, rebuildthedream.com will allow you to go online, read that contract for the American Dream. If you agree with those principles as they're laid out, you should sign up and you should be a member. You should not be by yourself. You should not be alone. You should not feel like you're in a minority when your views actually represent the silence supermajority in our country. And then, as I said, we're asking people to come to the summit, the Take Back the American Dream Summit in October, so we can get face-to-face and eyeball-to-eyeball and have real discussion. And in the meantime, we will be using technology after Labor Day that will allow the formation of what we call American Dream Teams, so people can start to self-organize around issues at the local level that make sense and that reflect the values of that contract. So this is something we are doing at light speed. But our view is, you mentioned that it's an ambitious effort. In some ways it is, in some ways it isn't. We think there's probably, if you look at the polling data, there's probably 30 to 40 million Americans right now who agree with that contract, who are not in anybody's organization, who've not had a chance to work together, who've not been given the opportunity to defend democracy and the middle class and all the great values that built the middle class in our country. And we think that those people, plus those who are not in the middle class but who've been struggling to get into the middle class for, you know, low these generations, standing together, we should be able to make a positive difference, and we should be able to overcome some of the discouraging advantages that the right wing has right now. We think this is not a right wing period in American politics. We don't think it's a left wing period. We think it is a volatile and turbulent period where people are going to be looking for answers, and we should be proud and loud and vocal about our answers. We've had three change elections in a row. 2006, people voted for change. 2008, they voted for change. 2010, they voted for change. The fact that the car is fishtailing across the road from left to right is a sign that we have not actually solved the problems, and people don't believe that the problems being, the solutions being offered are the right ones. And so this is not a time for us to fall into silence and despair and self-criticism and complaining about people who we can't affect their behavior anyway in Washington, D.C., acting as individuals. This is the time for us to come together and to stand up and to speak out for the values that we believe the country needs to hear about, and at least let the country make a decision. If it wants to follow these crazy people off the cliff, that's one thing. But right now, those of us who have better ideas have found a comfort zone in being disgusted by the Tea Party and frustrated with the White House, but never taking a stand ourselves to build the power that can make a difference against either one of those American actors.
Van Jones, I study media for a long time, and one of the recurring problems that progressive social movements have, that citizens' movements have, that are sort of not connected to people in power, is getting much media coverage at all, and then getting coverage that at all does justice to what is actually taking place. Back in 2010, for example, the Tea Party, one of the Tea Party groups, I forget which one, held its first great conference with Sarah Palin keynoting. I think it was in Nashville, Tennessee, somewhere in the South. And it drew 600 people, and it probably drew 600 journalists also. I mean, it was camera crews from every network, I believe, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Associated Press, the works were covering this. You would have thought it was a royal wedding. At the same time, 4 months later in Detroit, Michigan, the United States Social Forum was held, which drew between 15,000 and 20,000 activists from all over the country, disproportionately poor people, working class people, people of color, people definitely not connected. And, you know, you would have thought this was a dissident event in Soviet Russia, the way it was covered by the media. It was simply not covered whatsoever. It's been a great source of tension for people trying to go outside the conventional routes. How are you going to navigate these rough waters?
This will not be easy. This will be our greatest challenge, frankly, is not going to be getting progressives to cooperate on these core principles. I think we underestimate ourselves and quite a bit when we say, oh, well, progressives can't get together, progressives can't do anything. Oh, when I hear that, I say, well, you know what, I'm a historian not by profession, but by avocation. And I can think of, you know, I can go way back in history to find examples of progressives getting their act together. I go all the way back to 2008, right? I can go all the way back to 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when we got our acts together just fine. I don't think that we're going to have the problems that people have been predicting with progressives coming together. We've done that pretty dramatically already. And not just progressives, but also, you know, good independent thinking, good thinking independence. The problem will be the media's resistance and reluctance to cover in our full glory and strength, this movement, until we break through certain tipping points. Until that happens, though, there is an advantage that we have. You know, we are the media. Ordinary people, everybody listening to this recording, can right now go onto their Facebook page, right now go onto their Twitter feed, and say, I just joined the American Dream Movement, and I want to fight for the American Dream. You should join me. And there's a way that, because there is no media attention on this yet, that we can build something that, you know, that the media can't take away. There is a danger that you build that when the media helps you build it, the media can kill it. What the media builds, the media can destroy. What is built in an authentic way, the way the American Dream Movement is being built, person to person, literally Facebook page to Facebook page, email to email, below the radar screen, means that whenever the media pays attention to it, which is always is positive and negative, especially when it's progressive, we can have something very sturdy. So I think we should actually, again, take responsibility. We cannot challenge the Tea Party as individuals. We cannot make D.C., either party, act better as individuals. And we can't hope the mainstream corporate media will change its way as individuals. But collectively, we can build the political power, the political agenda, and even the people-powered media to get our message out anyway and to become a force.
Van Jones, I think I've done a disservice to you and to our listeners by going so deep into the program and not really doing justice to the 10-point program. I think I want to spend the rest of the program doing that because, you know, I think we get on a show like this sometimes inside baseball talking about strategy and tactics to the inner circle and forget that politics for most people is about whether you have a place to sleep, whether your kids have health care, you know, whether you have a job and self-respect. And let's get to the heart of the platform that was derived by the 20-odd thousand people who participated or had ideas and the hundreds of thousands of people who participated, because I do believe it's an extraordinary platform for the country. And it's amazing to me that all 10 of these issues are rightfully majoritarian positions, and they are extraordinarily progressive. So, you know, let's just work through the list, if we can, in the remainder of the show, Van Jones. Let's start with number one, invest in America's infrastructure.
Well, that came up again and again, that our, you know, we have roads and bridges and schools that are crumbling and falling down. And meanwhile, we have some of our best workers sitting idle. And we should, and frankly, some of our best workers who are older in their 40s and 50s, they should be in the pride years of their trade, teaching younger workers how to do the work of fixing and rebuilding the country. Instead, they're sitting idle on couches, watching television, getting more depressed. It's not, you know, you're not wasting money when you're investing in the infrastructure of a nation. That's how you keep a nation a first-rate country. And that came up over and over again. And that money, if we have money for these wars and this other stuff and bailouts, we should have money to rebuild America and put people back to work.
I mean, when we talk about infrastructure, too, I think a lot of Americans don't fully appreciate, if they haven't left the country, just what decrepit shape this country is in compared to virtually every other advanced industrial country in the world, and some not advanced industrial countries.
Well, I mean, it is a shame, and this should be an area of bipartisan agreement. Let's not forget those of us who have deep ties in California. California's incredible university system and the highway system and all was done under Republican governors who understood that you cannot just, for instance, if you're running a company, take and take and take from the company and never reinvest in the company. If you do that, you'll have a crappy company. Well, that's true for a country. You can't just let the wealthy and the corporations just take and take and take from America, but never give anything back in the way of taxes and wages that would allow us to keep a middle class. If you do that, you're going to wind up going from a first-rate to a third-rate country. And so that was an area of bipartisan agreement, and I think it can be, again, that you have to reinvest in America.
Number two is an issue near and dear to your heart, creating 21st-century energy jobs. What does that mean?
Well, that means doing what we know we must do, which is transition off of a dirty planet-baking energy source to use more and more clean and green sources of energy, like solar, like wind, like smart advanced biofuels, hydro, and others. And what we know is that those are the industries of tomorrow. If you want to have the jobs of tomorrow, you have to focus on the industries of tomorrow. And energy is the big issue of the new century, regardless of what the bought and paid for deniers say, bought and paid for by big oil. We know that both from an energy supply point of view and from a climate change point of view, clean energy is going to be a huge part of the new century. That's why China is moving so aggressively to lock up all markets and gobble up all the enterprises. And we should be doing that here. One thing Americans can do historically is come up with great ideas and out-innovate the rest of the world. We should be doing that on clean energy and creating jobs.
The third thing on the list is something that if someone had told me growing up in the 1960s in Cleveland, Ohio, or the 1970s, that there would come a day when the very existence of meaningful public education as a mass popular right, as a citizen's right in this country, would be in question, I would have thought that was absurd. Now it looks like it's absurd to think what I used to think. What are we going to do about public education? What's your view?
Well, number one, we've got to be able to have the kind of salaries and wages that will continue to attract good talent. People don't become teachers because they want to be rich, but they shouldn't have to be poor to follow that passion to teach young people. There is a big split, obviously, among progressives about how much we should focus on charter schools and those kinds of reform versus defending our school teachers from the kinds of right-wing attacks they've been subjected to. This movement has enough room for both approaches. We certainly should not be allowing the right wing that doesn't even believe in public education set the terms of any reform. And we should also be open to reforms that empower teachers and help children learn better.
There are so many here I'd like to talk about, but I want to skip ahead to one that I don't think gets necessarily the attention it ought to. It's number five. You call it make work pay. I assume that means a living wage, and I assume that means a right to have a job.
It means a right to in this country and to work under conditions that are dignified conditions in terms of wages. The ability, the right to organize in America, which if in any third world country, there was a movement afoot to say that people would not have their human right to organize as workers and to stand together and bargain with their employers for fair wages and for safe working conditions. We would say, well, that movement would be public enemy number one. And if you can imagine a political leader standing up in any country in the world saying they don't believe that human beings have the right to improve their working conditions. You would say, oh, my God, what kind of dictatorship is emerging in that country? Well, that is what the Tea Party movement is calling for. They do not believe that the right for American workers to stand together and to sit down with their employers and come up with the best terms possible for working families in America, inside of profitability, certainly for companies, and certainly inside of what's necessary for government to move forward. But the basic idea that America's workers don't have any rights is something they signed on to, which would appall anyone in the world in this century. These are the kinds of things that, to your point, we never thought we'd have to launch a mass movement to defend. This is just the American way. These ideas are the ideas that inspired the world. These ideas that are in this contract, which I know we won't now have a chance to go all the way through, but the ideas in this contract are the ideas that made the last century the American century.
Well, Van Jones, on that note, I want to thank you so much for taking an hour from your very busy schedule to join us today on Media Matters. It's really been a privilege to have you. I look forward to working with you and seeing you in the future. Good luck with your work, and again, thank you very much. And I'll be back with everyone in 167 hours. Until then, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The forecast for East Central Illinois. Today, mostly cloudy with a high near 61. Tonight, also cloudy with a low around 36. Tomorrow, sunny with a high near 56. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with a low around 36. Tuesday, sunny with a high near 65. And Tuesday night, mostly clear with a low around 43. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.